Welcome to the Florida Roundup statewide edition today. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, we're talking about offshore drilling this Friday. The Trump administration recently said it wants to open up 90% of America's coastline to oil drilling. Now, 90% means they want to exempt Florida from that offshore drilling plan. The proposal was announced early this month, and it reverses an Obama administration ban on drilling in the ocean. Waters in the Gulf of Mexico that have been off limits for decades would be available for drilling starting in the year 2023 under this plan, which Florida leaders, by the way, on both sides of the aisle vehemently oppose. Governor Rick Scott met with Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke at the Tallahassee Airport shortly after this announcement, and Zinke emerged from the meeting saying Florida was out.
We are going to take the new oil platforms, new oil gas platforms off the table, off the Florida coastlines. And so for Floridians, we are not drilling off the coast of Florida.
A simple declarative statement there, Melissa.
Yes.
Earlier this month, the Interior Department published a draft of a five-year drilling plan in the Federal Register on January 8th. But it has not provided any details about how Florida will be exempted from that plan. The Florida Democratic Senator Bill Nelson took his displeasure with Zinke and Governor Scott to the Senate floor last week.
Design a plan for the entire U.S., publish it on Monday, and take it back on Tuesday for Florida. For political reasons.
Now, in retaliation, Nelson has placed a hold on three Interior Department nominees who are slated to work under Secretary Zinke. Meantime, plenty of states are plenty mad about Florida's possible exemption from offshore drilling. Susan Glickman is the Florida director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
There are other states also that plan to sue the federal government because they arbitrarily took Florida off the table. And they cited the economic reasons because we're such a tourism-based state. But there are a lot of other states that have tourism. And so there are still a lot of legal wrangling that's going to go on. So we're not out of the woods yet.
Yeah, a lot of wrangling, a lot of questions still asking here. Congressman Francis Rooney from Naples wants to permanently ban drilling off of Florida's beaches. We spoke with the congressman earlier today. Congressman Rooney, thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition. What needs to happen to ensure that offshore drilling does not happen off the coast of Florida?
Well, I think we need to enshrine Secretary Zinke's tweet into a public law. That will guarantee that drilling and related seismic don't occur. I've introduced a bill to it's H.R. 4770 to do the simplest possible thing for the Eastern Gulf, which is to just extend the moratorium that Jeb and Senator Martinez got done in 2006, which expires in 2022.
Jeb, of course, is former Governor Jeb Bush of Florida.
Right. Yeah, my tactic is to do the very simplest and hopefully easiest thing to get accomplished for the Eastern Gulf. Start with that.
So your sense right now is, despite the proclamation at the Tallahassee Airport by Governor Scott and the Interior Secretary, drilling still, by the letter of the law and the regulation, could still happen off the coast of Florida?
Well, the devil's in the details. All we have is a press conference and a Twitter feed right now. We'll have to see exactly how they enshrine this and carve out of Florida into their plan, you know, when it's finalized.
And let me ask you, Congressman Rooney,
anything can change with regulators.
Surely there's bipartisan agreement on this. Senator Nelson, a Democrat, took to the Senate floor to talk about this as well. What would you say to those who feel from other states that it's not fair for Florida to get this exemption, particular lawmakers, your colleagues from California in particular? They say, you know, the threat to tourism in their state from oil and gas activity opens the door for them to go to Secretary Zinke and argue that they should also be exempt from offshore drilling.
Yeah, first of all, it is a bipartisan issue in Florida. I went on the House floor yesterday, and you can look on my website and see my theatrical little thing there, but I basically said nobody wants offshore drilling in Florida, not Republican, not Democrat, not rich, not poor, not anybody, because we are about our environment in Florida. And the other states that are figuring this out now are a little day late and a dollar short. We've been ahead of this thing for a long time. Like I say, Senator Martinez got that bill passed in 2006. And California has offshore platforms off of Santa Barbara.
Hmm.
What would you say, too, as well, Congressman, to critics who've said that the President Trump, Secretary Zinke, have carved out Florida to perhaps help Governor Scott's political fortunes as he's considering a bid to take out Senator Nelson and run for the Senate?
Well, yeah, I don't know what all their motives might be, but I will say it's good that they realize that nobody wants offshore drilling in Florida, not Rick Scott, not Bill Nelson, not Francis Rooney, not anybody. And I appreciate him listening to our citizens. I wrote Zinke as soon as I got word a few weeks ago of this rumor that they were going to try to do some comprehensive advancement of these five-year plans, including in the Central and Eastern Gulf.
Congressman, what about your proposal for a moratorium in the Eastern Gulf? Would you like to expand that around the entire peninsula and the panhandle?
Yes, I've joined in on every bill there is to limit petroleum activity anywhere in Florida. I joined on Kathy Castor's bill, which includes some other things in addition to the moratorium.
She's a Democrat representative from the Tampa Bay area.
Yes, yeah. I've joined on John Rutherford's bill to deal with the Atlantic.
And he's a Republican congressman from Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's a bipartisan deal. And I've tried to make the argument to the leadership around here that because we're conservative Republicans, we also care about the environment, just like the environmentalist groups and everybody else. I said, you all don't understand that maybe the Sierra Club doesn't have any Republicans on it up in Wisconsin or New York or something. But in Southwest Florida, we've got business leaders and even ex-energy CEOs on the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, on Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation, and on the Everglades Foundation.
And we know ocean tides and Gulf streams are not partisan either. And we saw how one state allowing drilling off its coastline can impact Florida with the Horizon spill back several years ago. We've heard from governors in New York and South Carolina that would also like a moratorium on offshore drilling off of their coastlines. Would you support expanding that moratorium for other congressmen, other states that would like it?
Well, you know, I think every state needs to express themselves. You know, I'm sorry that those guys are a day late and a dollar short and that Florida figured this out a long time ago. But I think some states like it. You know, the guys in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana and Texas love offshore drilling, and more power to them. But I don't want it anywhere near Florida. And what you need to know is the first thing they're going to drill if they get the chance is the Destin Dome, which comes within 10 miles of Destin. And I don't know if you all are mariners. I'm a lifelong offshore sailor. There's a clockwise current that runs east across North Florida and down the Southwest Florida coast and feeds into the Gulf Stream at Key West. And so if you get a spill up there, we're going to see it all over the West Coast.
And Congressman, what would you say to your colleagues on the other side of the aisle, Democrats who might accuse you of hypocrisy? You know, just a few years ago, the chant at the Republican convention was drill, baby, drill, energy independence. What would you say to those who would say that you're adopting, you know, a NIMBY posture on this issue?
Sure. First of all, you've never heard me say that about offshore drilling near Florida, ever, ever. I'm a lifelong mariner, conservationist, fisherman, and all that. But the other thing that the people need to realize is that because of the shale revolution, we are going to be energy independent regardless of whether there's ever any more offshore rig anywhere. We have we're producing 16 million barrels a day right now out of shale, and as late as 2006, we were only producing 8.3. We're about to pass Saudi Arabia in energy production. We have more shale reserves. We have more shale reserves than Russia or Saudi Arabia have conventional reserves.
The fracking revolution has certainly re-energized the American energy industry, has brought prices down for the commodity. But what about fracking in Florida? Should your moratorium that you'd like on offshore drilling in the Eastern Gulf be expanded inland?
And there's been legislation to ban fracking in Florida, too.
Yeah, there is. It's a state issue. And I definitely would encourage before anybody would allow fracking, that they do the geological studies that some of these bills have called for. There are some geological substrata, underground strata, that are more easily undermined by hydraulic fracking and the pressures that that presents than other ones.
Well, so as you said, you're awaiting more word from Secretary Zinke in a holding pattern for now on this issue, I suppose?
No, I am going all out. This is full pads football. I'm going all out to get my bill passed and put into something that will pass in the Senate.
And are coordinating with Senator Nelson on this? What's the interaction
haven't
there?
Haven't yet. I'm focused on the House. I've got to get something out of the House. And then I would certainly coordinate with anybody that can help turn that thing into a public law.
And what about Senator Rubio's office? Has there been communication with him on this?
You know, Senator Rubio's kind of got an interesting position. He doesn't want offshore drilling, but he wants to get some of the royalty money. So when I get a chance to talk to him, I think I'm going to say to him, forget the money. We have such a solvent state, good state government, low taxes. We don't need to take blood money from oil companies and pollute our shores.
Florida Congressman Francis Rooney, blood money, my goodness. And it's the Florida Roundup. What do you think about the exemption on offshore drilling for Florida? Call us from anywhere in the state. 305-995-1800 is the number. Joining us now with more on this is Jenny Stiletovich, environmental reporter with the Miami Herald. And Jenny, you know, besides Florida, California, arguably one of the states that could also face harm to its tourism industry when you talk about this issue of oil drilling. Why do you think Zinke didn't give California this exemption?
Well, you guys talked about that over the last 10 minutes, politics. The governor of California is a Democrat, doesn't have a relation, or well, I shouldn't say doesn't have a relationship with the president, but a strong one like the governor of Florida has.
But, you know, the political aspect of this is certainly important. You know, Congressman Rooney saying Florida got out in front of this. But California has, you know, savvy politicians, too. It's a big, important state. They have a big, muscular tourism arm as well. Do you just see this as because the Republicans are in power right now? There's a Republican president that it's simply that the Republicans held sway here and California is a Democratic state, so they lost out?
I don't know. It would seem like the obvious answer. I know that Secretary Zinke has been to Florida a few times. And I was just talking to somebody yesterday who said he seems like he has a soft spot in his heart for the state because when he was considering hiking the national park fees, he excluded Everglades National Park, but a lot of other popular parks got included. So, you know, I don't know.
Jenny, let me ask you about where the oil is off of Florida's coastline. Congressman Rooney said, he thinks that should, you know, drills be invited off the coastline, it would be up near the panhandle. Where is the oil? Where is the energy industry looking off the shores of Florida for oil, and what do we know where it is in terms of the Gulf Coast or the Atlantic Coast?
Well, I think it's they've looked almost exclusively recently in off the Gulf Coast. The Eastern Gulf is close to areas they're already drilling. They have a lot of information about that. They have the infrastructure there. I think all eyes are on the Eastern Gulf. The Atlantic Coast hasn't been. The data they have from the Atlantic coast is decades old. The Florida Keys, I think it was the 1950s when they last drilled there. However, that said, Cuba started drilling, opening its waters in 2013. So there's a lot of information coming from Cuba that the oil industry is paying a lot of attention to. And it's so close to Florida shores, I think that, you know, they're watching that carefully.
In the Florida Straits, absolutely. Cuba began looking for oil there again. Speaking of near the Florida Straits and the Gulf Stream, Paul is joining the Florida Roundup statewide edition from the southernmost point in Key West. Paul, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts on this issue. Paul, are you with us? Paul, we're having a little trouble with our phone lines. We'll get our engineers on that. But I think Paul's question here, an issue, Jenny, was about the moratorium that has been on offshore drilling when it comes to Florida and federal policy. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think like the congressman said, it's set to expire at 2022. And unless somebody does something, it's going to expire. The way this timetable is set up, they would open up waters in 2023 for leasing. So unless something's done, the leases will go up on the auction block.
Jenny.
Well, I take that back, though, because now the Secretary said that Florida is not on the table. So,
gotcha. And have you gotten anything out of the governor's office about Governor Scott's change in position on oil drilling? He was fine with it. Now he's against it. And coincidentally, he's likely going to be running for Senate as he's sort of tacking to the center on a range of issues. This is one of them.
Right. I think that as this, you know, if he runs for senator, he's definitely been trying to build an environmental record for himself. And as the congressman said, by, you know, opposition to oil drilling in Florida, off Florida shores, is bipartisan. My colleague David Smiley is going to be in Wynwood today with the governor. I think he's going to ask him about something that's come up today in Washington at a committee hearing. The acting director talked about whether or not Florida was officially in or out, and said that officially it was not out of the plan. So tune in to David.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Wynwood being a neighborhood in the city of Miami. This happened this morning, Friday morning in Washington. It was a committee, House committee hearing, where it was the acting director of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, where he stated that Florida is not off the table for offshore drilling activities. And Congressman Rooney referred to that, Melissa, when he talked about, mm-hmm. you know, he's got the statement from Zinke, he's got the tweet from Zinke, but until it's written down somewhere in a piece of legislation or a piece of rulemaking that regulators are going to follow, it is just words from a cabinet secretary.
That's right. And it was interesting to hear Congressman Rooney, Tom, say he's playing football with full pads to try to defeat this thing. And, you know, it's funny. How many years has it been now, Jenny, since the Deepwater Horizon spill? People have short memories, don't they? I mean, they tend to forget how long that oil leak spewed and how much damage it caused. And so when you see this bipartisan opposition from politicians to the spill, I think that you kind of have to hearken back to how tourism was decimated in so many counties, so many Gulf counties, and for how many months, to understand why they are rising up so vehemently against this, because it's been some time since that happened. But if you remember the devastation, then you get an idea of why they're being so strong in their opposition.
That's right. I mean, this spill happened in 2010. 11 workers were killed. 3 million barrels of oil spilled. Some people might have short memories. I think the people who live in those communities and the fishing guides and the people who depend on Florida waters for their income or live there have not forgotten.
Coming up on 8 years in April since the Deepwater Horizon spill. Jenny Stiletovich covering the environment for the Miami Herald with us from Doral, talking about offshore drilling in Florida. Jenny, always great to have you on the program. We got plenty more to come this hour. Stick with us. You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
And welcome back to the Florida Roundup statewide edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And in Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. State law says pedestrians who do not use a crosswalk to cross the street, Melissa, can be ticketed by police and forced to pay a fine. Now, a Florida Times Union ProPublica investigation looked at these tickets in four large counties ranging from 2012 to 2017. And the findings, Melissa, show that been a lot of mistakes made by law enforcement.
That's right, Tom. It's really interesting to look at this data, as reporters have done. And here's what they found. These kinds of tickets, they found, were often issued in error, sometimes with significant consequences for the person who was improperly ticketed. Even worse, black pedestrians get a disproportionate number of these improperly issued tickets. For example, black residents make up 16% of the population in Miami-Dade, but they received 29% of the tickets that were given out in error. Over in Broward County, black people make up 30% of the population, but they got 61% of the bad tickets. Here with more about this, we welcome Ben Konark. He's reporter with the Florida Times Union and Jacksonville.com, and Topher Sanders. He's reporter for ProPublica. Thanks so much for being with us. Ben, let's start with you. This whole investigation began, as I understand it, when you noticed video, I believe, of a guy in Jacksonville being ticketed for a pedestrian infraction, and it caught your eye. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And thanks for having me, Melissa. Thank you. So there was a viral video that was making rounds on Facebook, and I think the reason it went viral is just a young black man and a white officer and a very tense exchange, very contentious, and I think we're used to seeing those kind of videos, unfortunately, but this one was all over a jaywalking ticket, which is a little different. I watched the video and decided it was worth doing a story. And when I contacted the sheriff's office and asked, what citations he'd been given, a young man named Devontae Shipman, I found out that one of them actually, it didn't take me more than 5 minutes to figure out that that wasn't meant for pedestrians. It was a citation meant for motorists. So from there, he was given a citation for not having a driver's license, which it's kind of harkens back to these old racist black code laws where you kind of have to have documentation on you if you're black. And that's what it connotated for a lot of people.
It's 305-995-1800 for questions from anywhere in Florida about the Times Union ProPublica investigation. It's called Walking While Black. Topher Sanders with ProPublica. What did the investigation show when you looked into why minorities seem to be getting a disproportionate share of these tickets?
Thanks for having me, by the way.
Sure.
It looked simply to be where the enforcement was taking place. Enforcement was concentrated in areas where the predominant resident there was African American, and therefore that's who was who bore the brunt of the enforcement.
Topher, help me understand and help us understand the difference between the mistaken tickets that that Ben talks about and these tickets that were disproportionately written for or to African Americans.
Yeah, great question. Thank you for that. So disproportionality existed in both universes of tickets. So disproportionality was across the board, whether it was a bad ticket or a ticket that we couldn't determine the validity of. Disproportionality to African Americans was universal. So how we describe the tickets that are in error? Simply this: there's a state law that says you got to walk through a crosswalk only in a certain geographical part of your town. And what that means is if you're in an area where there's a traffic light intersection to your left and a traffic light intersection to your right, and those are the intervening intersections, then you cannot walk outside the crosswalk. Mm-hmm. But if there's an open intersection to your right but a traffic light to your left, then you are allowed to walk across the street as long as you don't violate any other state pedestrian laws wherever you please. And there are hundreds of people in Jacksonville and thousands of people throughout the state of Florida who have been given that ticket inappropriately in areas where the state law allows them to walk across the street.
So those were the erroneous tickets. And for those, for that universe of tickets, Topher, that you looked at that seemed to be justified given the rule that was broken, what was that disproportionality looked like? What did that look like for African Americans?
Across the state, the disproportionality was almost 2-to-1 in any location you looked at. For example, in Jacksonville, African Americans make up 29% of the population. But when you look at just the tickets that were given out by the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, 59% of all pedestrian tickets were given to black residents.
And Ben Konark, this investigation, I think it's fair to say, sparked a lot of discussion and a lot of pushback. From the Duval County Sheriff's Office in particular, they have disputed the findings of Walking While Black. They have taken issue with your methodology and just the overall tone of the investigation. Well, what is the Times Union's response?
You know, I don't think they have disputed the findings or the methodology. What we haven't heard anything in regards to inaccuracies until the most recent story.
And yeah, the most recent story they disputed where you talked about public officials calling for a moratorium, temporary moratorium on the issuing of pedestrian tickets.
And I think their issue really came down to semantics as to what you call a review by the state attorney's office. But, you know, we responded thoroughly with a point-by-point refutation. And I just think it's unfortunate and it's a distraction from what really, the what we should be talking about, which is these tickets. But I will say this, I'd encourage people to go seek out our response and read that. You know, beyond that, we're trying to steer the conversation back away from semantics and to speak to the actual findings from the initial, you know, the initial story. We never heard anything from the sheriff's office, and we continue not to hear anything disputing the accuracy of our reporting as it comes to the main story here, which is disproportionate issuing these tickets.
And you've talked about this before on the air. You see this issue of the issuing of pedestrian tickets disproportionately being given out to people of color as an instance of systemic bias. And Topher Sanders, could you talk about this as well? Is the issuing of these tickets another version, in your view, in ProPublica's view, of, for example, stop and frisk, which became an unconstitutional practice for law enforcement in New York?
Yeah, and you know, I think for on just to be technical, it's not stop and frisk because there's a state statute that is the purported means for the stop. Now, if you're some of the people who have received these erroneous tickets and you were stopped inappropriately and then you were asked and the interaction led to a search or anything else, you might have a different perspective whether or not you experienced stop and frisk because technically you weren't supposed to be stopped to begin with. So I think it's I think that's something that still has to be explored a little deeper, Melissa. But on a technical basis, they have a state statute. They're using the state laws to purportedly justify these stops, and that is what they're doing.
Ben, let me ask you about the role of pedestrian safety here, because when there are these polls and statistical reports that come out about the safety of pedestrians in the United States, a number of Florida cities wound up high on that list of places where it's just not safe to walk.
Right.
In the state of Florida. We know that here in South Florida. You know that in Jacksonville certainly as well.
Sure.
So when you engage with law enforcement about the practice of even ticketing about these kinds of offenses, what role does pedestrian safety play for them?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because there is a bit of confusion about what role pedestrian tickets play in reinforcing safety. And you know, the people we really spoke to a lot about this were more of from the planning world, the pedestrian safety world, and there's widespread unanimous agreement in planning circles that ticketing pedestrians is not going to change behavior in any meaningful way. The only thing that does that is building more infrastructure, and that brings us back to Florida having a statewide issue with this. It's because of the infrastructure. It's because of when the infrastructure was built and who it was built for. In other words, the infrastructure in Florida cities is built for cars. There are six-lane highways. They stretch on for long periods of time without traffic lights because they want to move as much volume as quickly as possible through these corridors. What happens when you build cities like that is that there are communities that get left on the fringes on either end of these highways, and they don't have any way to get across the street. So a lot of the feedback, critical feedback we've gotten in Jacksonville saying, well, I drive down Beach Boulevard, which is a big boulevard here, or Atlantic Boulevard, and I see people running in front of my car that I almost hit them, and Arlington Expressway. And the point that I make to that is that no one enjoys doing that, right? People are running across the street not because they think it's fun or because, you know, they don't care about getting hit by a car. It's because they have no safe places to cross. As far as the sheriff's office and law enforcement role in this, they say that they're ticketing to keep people safe. A more nuanced view we heard from the Orlando Police Department is like, yeah, we use the tickets, but we ticket motorists because we realize that motorist behavior is more likely to cause a death or an injury than pedestrian behavior. You're talking about a fleshy body made of skin and bones versus a 2,000-pound or, you know, however much weight you have behind a steel automobile. So, you know, it seems more useful to me to be telling motorists to yield to pedestrians, because I can tell you as a person who lives in Jacksonville, motorists don't yield to pedestrians. You could be standing next to a sign that tells them it's a state law to yield to pedestrians, and they won't slow down and they won't give you the time of day.
And if you're just tuning in here on the Florida Roundup, we're talking with the reporters behind the Florida Times Union ProPublica's investigation, Walking While Black, looking at the sometimes improper issuing around the state of pedestrian tickets. Topher Sanders of ProPublica, your investigation found that sometimes when these tickets are issued to pedestrians, if they can't afford to pay them, it can result in a downward spiral. bankruptcy, even jail. Could you also tell us a little bit about Sheriff's Department's response to your investigation? I believe the Duval Sheriff said that perhaps African-Americans are jaywalking more often. Your investigation found that the numbers don't show that. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that comment in particular came from Undersheriff, the Sheriff's Office number two in the office. And, yeah, it's one thing I think is important to note, that's a piggyback off of what Ben said, was we did a track level analysis, census track analysis, doing a correlation study on where people were dying and where the police officers were giving the tickets in Duval County. And there was not a strong relationship between the two, meaning the locations where people were dying, there was no strong relationship between that and where officers are giving the tickets. And we found census tracts where they would be towards the top of the list on the number of pedestrian tickets they received. But in the last 5 years, nobody died in that census tract. Yet they were towards the top of the list on the number of tickets. And no surprise, that census tract would be 98, 99% black. So it was a very revealing correlation study, and it basically showed that there didn't seem to be a strong relationship at all between where people die and where tickets are given.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Thank you for being with us. Topher Sanders, reporter for ProPublica, and Ben Conrack with Florida Times Union and Jacksonville.com. Ben and Topher, what's the consequence of receiving one of these tickets? What's the penalty?
Yeah, that's it's an important point. It's only a $65 ticket, but it can have long-term ramifications as a result. So if you get one of these tickets, and there's a few different dynamics going on here, but if you get one of these tickets and either can't pay it, which we've met people who felt they couldn't pay it, and in fact, a couple people like that, or you don't pay it and you get a letter later, and a lot of the people, because these tickets are so heavily concentrated in poor areas, they might be moving around. They might not ever receive the letter letting them know, hey, you got the ticket, you need to pay it. What happens if you ignore it is your credit score takes a pretty big hit. And then after that, you lose your driver's license. And we've talked to one person who lost her driver's license over a ticket that actually should have never been issued in the first place. It was one of these erroneous tickets. And as a result, she, has to find a way to pay this off to get her license back because she wants to make money by driving for Uber. But she can't get her license back because in order to take out a loan, one of the only things she can do is take out a loan against her title. And she can't do that legally anymore because her driver's license is suspended. So it really was one of the more eye-opening parts for Topher and I was to realize just how widespread these financial consequences can be, because $65 might not sound like a lot to you or me. But for a lot of these people, $65 it's like $1,000.
It could
us.
Be a downward spiral if you're a person living in poverty. So, Topher Sanders, in the wake of this report, and you looked at several counties around Florida, have any changes come out of this?
None that we can see. I mean, people are more aware of the issue. I think in Jacksonville, you're seeing community members have tough questions for people in power, for the sheriff, for city council members, for whether or not this is something that needs to be put on a pause and allow for the sheriff's office to do a deep evaluation of how its officers are using pedestrian tickets and pedestrian enforcement. But across the state, there's been interest from some lawmakers. They've asked some questions, but there hasn't been a bill filed or anything like that to our knowledge.
But Ben Conrack, certainly community activists are calling for a pause in the issuing of these tickets. And at a certain point, a couple of public officials joined that call, but then they sort of walked that back.
One of them did, yeah. And, I think the people who are really clued in to this kind of stuff have stood by their guns. That would be the public defender, Charlie Kofer, Lori Boyer, who actually was the first person to tell Topher and I, hey, you might want to check out this crosswalk law because I don't think the police understand it.
She's on the Jacksonville City Council. Yeah.
So, and then beyond that, beyond the community activism, what I think has been gratifying as a reporter in Jacksonville to see is that for a long time, people who had concerns about racial profiling were kind of told they, you know, that they're imagining this, that they're making this up, that there is no racial profiling in Jacksonville. What we've given them is hard data.
So those folks feel validated by your reporting.
Yes, I think a lot of people do, and they feel like now people have to listen to them. Where as a long period of time, their voices were sort of ignored.
It's been along those lines. Have you gotten a hint of anything systemic in that regard?
In what way? As far as racial profiling?
Correct, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, it's really hard to quantify even right. with pedestrian tickets, right? Because even with these tickets, we're only viewing a sliver of what's going on.
Yeah.
There are tons of people every day who get stopped. Maybe they get a warning. Maybe they get no paperwork. A lot of police officers, they don't want to bother with the paperwork unless they have a reason to. So if you're going to stop someone for being, you know, a suspicious person, but you don't find anything on them, you might not write any, there might not be a paper trail there. So it's really hard to quantify racial profiling. What we've done is offer a keyhole into that, but there's a whole other world that we don't quite have access to.
One other quick, just last question. Is this a source of funding for municipalities handing out these tickets, even though they're relatively low fine of $65 compared to what's out there? Is there a lot of money coming in?
You think of police being told, you know, make sure you hit your quota of tickets.
Right.
Yeah.
Topher, you want to take that?
Yeah. So, first of all, the sheriff said there's absolutely no quota. So that's from his lips. So I'll take him at his word. There are no quotas. And it doesn't appear that this is a big moneymaker. A lot of people don't pay the fines. What we found is that in a 4 or 5 year period, 49%. Of the people who got a pedestrian ticket, they saw their license suspended because they didn't pay the fine.
Okay, and we're out of time, but Topher Sanders, Ben Konark, the investigation is Walking While Black. This is the Florida Roundup with Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition right now. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, yet another accuser has come forward to talk about her experience with now former state Senator Jack Latvala and sexual harassment in the state capitol. Laura McLeod was a longtime lobbyist who recently gave up that career. She is now a legislative aide for state Senator Lauren Book. McLeod's account of her experiences with Latvala, including an affair with him some 20 years ago, is in the Miami Herald this week. Now, McLeod shares text messages and journal entries to relay the complicated nature of the relationship between her and Latvala.
Yeah, evidence, Melissa, that she and others provided to a special master's investigation in the Florida Senate led retired Judge Ronald Swanson to conclude there was probable cause that former Senator Latvala had violated Senate misconduct rules and had sexually harassed a legislative aide. Mary Ellen Klaus writes in the Herald that Tallahassee's political culture and social scene are fueled by campaign contributions. Marital infidelity seems to be an open secret, and those with the most political power, mainly men in the state legislature, are able to use sex as both a tool and a weapon. This scandal continues in Tallahassee and statewide. Mary Ellen joins us now from our sister station, WFSU, in Tallahassee. Mary Ellen, welcome back to the program. Why did Laura McLeod decide to come forward now come publicly tell her story?
Well, it's good to be here, and I think it's important to remember that Laura McLeod spent many years not coming forward. This has been something that obviously weighed on her for a very long time. She, after last year's legislative session, she decided it was just, she'd had enough. She felt so trapped in this harassment cycle with Senator Latvala that she told me that she just didn't want to ask for a vote again. So she decided to get out of lobbying and quit her job as working for a nonprofit as their lead lobbyist and the association's executive director. She then was looking for work, and Lauren Book happened to have an opening.
You know, and
the reason.
Oh, go ahead.
Go. I was going to say the reason she came forward is a multitude of factors. I certainly think the fact that Rachel Perrin Rogers, the legislative aide who originally came forward with her initial allegation, persuaded Laura McLeod to talk to the investigators with the Senate, but she didn't ever want to have her name come forward. She actually had to be subpoenaed by the special master before she would talk to him.
Right. And, you know, in reading your account of this, Mary Ellen, I was struck by how common these types of situations are in the workplace. I mean, granted, Tallahassee is a unique kind of workplace, but Laura McLeod was in a situation that was sort of a murky, nuanced situation. She, you know, called herself a flawed messenger for the Me Too movement because she had had this prior sexual relationship with Letvalla, but then she was in a position where, in order to be effective in her job, she had to put up with these unwanted sexual advances from this more powerful male colleague. And so many women all over the country are in that type of professional dynamic. I think so many women can relate to that. And it can be, I think, hard for men to understand that sometimes. And you could feel her reluctance in trying to even explain that. But I think so many women can relate to that sort of narrative.
I think that's a really good point. You know, she described herself as a flawed messenger because she had a relationship 20 years ago with him. She was at the end of a very difficult divorce. He was still in his marriage, and they had an affair. It lasted 3 years, and then it broke off. And she didn't. She had casual contact with him, but it wasn't until he returned to the Senate then in 2011 that she started to feel this harassment from him. And she thinks that a lot of it was he had reached a position where he sort of felt that he was entitled to it, according to her description.
Mary Ellen, what has been the former senator's response to her publicly telling her story?
Well, he has not specifically spoken about the allegations except to say that he is very this was a rehash of what the special master report had indicated and denied that he traded sexual encounters for any legislation. And that is something that came out in the special master's report. So he's denied he's done anything wrong here. He does acknowledge that he had a relationship, and he's apologized to his family and his wife that it happened while they were married. He's subsequently been remarried, and his now new wife was married to him when he was soliciting sex from Laura McLeod.
What's going to happen to the funds Jack Letvalla had raised for his gubernatorial bid, by the way?
He is still a candidate.
He's still officially a candidate, right?
Right, right. So that money is, he's still able to use it as long as it's promoting his candidacy. He did get a legal opinion that said that it was all right for him to use his political committee money to pay for his lawyer to defend himself against these sexual harassment claims.
Let's remind folks here that you are listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Speaking with Mary Ellen Klass from the Miami Herald about the latest public story now of another accuser of sexual harassment and misconduct coming out against now former state senator Jack Letvalla. Mary Ellen, let me ask you about something you wrote in this piece when you talk about the culture of Tallahassee. And a lot has been written and speculated about the culture of Tallahassee. You have lived and reported on that culture for a good number of years. You talk about it feeding upon a social scene that includes junkets to concerts, resorts, and sporting events in the name of fundraising is fueled by an unlimited stream of campaign contributions. Marital infidelity is often condoned and protected. Is that culture over with these sexual harassment scandals and investigations?
You know, it's been an interesting couple months here in Tallahassee.
I guess so.
That's a huge understatement, right?
Yeah.
But even as we just renewed, you know, everyone came back for the start of the legislative session a couple weeks ago, the the attitude and energy is just not the same. So this has definitely shrouded the entire Capitol with a sense of forbearing, and I really do think people feel uncomfortable and on guard. Now, one thing is there's a lot of people that don't engage in these after-hours parties and events, but the thing is Tallahassee is so far away from the major metro areas of the rest of the state that many of the people who come up here are out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
I think that contributes in many ways to, you know, the Las Vegas cliche of yeah. what happens in Las Vegas stays there. It's almost the same in Tallahassee, and people talk about that.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that.
Though. Yeah. It is such a vapid yeah, explanation.
Yeah. It's not okay.
Morality in Miami and Jacksonville is different than morality or ethics in Tallahassee.
I've heard this saying, you know, here in Duval County, well, Jacksonville is for the wives and Tallahassee is for the girlfriends, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And so do you honestly think it will change permanently?
Well, I do think that people are so much more on guard right now. as one simple little example, we have our annual press corps skits in which we make fun of legislators and lobbyists and make fun mm-hmm. of ourselves. That's every year. It's happening next Tuesday. But people are so afraid to even be out drinking and mingling with each other with the press there that ticket sales are really low this year. you know, it's tamping down the energy. It's an interesting dynamic. But, you know, everything happens in cycles, and I just think this will pass.
I think eventually the liquor will start flowing again.
The dynamics aren't changing. Until you change the fundamentals, which is the concentration of power in the hands of a few, the enormous amounts of
and perhaps
money
getting more women elected to office in Tallahassee too, right?
Yeah. Now they have just adopted our the Senate has just put out a new employment policy as of yesterday that really explicitly lays out what is sexual harassment, what's unacceptable behavior. And they're going to, they say that they will now hold all employees and all senators to these new standards. What they did not do is put them in their Senate rules. So there is still a little bit of a lengthy and convoluted process to hold senators accountable.
The policy does take effect immediately. Marianne Klaus writes mm-hmm. about the Florida State Legislature for the Miami Herald with us from our sister station in Tallahassee.
Well, Tom, this may be the most Florida story ever. Did you hear about this? Golfers in Naples saw a horrifying display of nature last week, but they just kept right on playing.
This was unbelievable, Melissa. Pictures were taken at the 10th hole of the golf club in Naples, and they've gone viral. You've probably seen them certainly on social media and elsewhere. It was an alligator lounging by the water, a python wrapped around it.
Yeah, it was incredible to look at. Now, they say the snake's head was in the gator's mouth. But they're guessing the gator won this epic battle, Tom, because they saw it eventually pull the snake into the water.
Score one for the home team. The Gators got the tourists on this one, the python. Pictures also, of course, here, Melissa, because this is winter golf in Florida, right? The golfers just going about their business, certainly taking the time to take a picture, but then playing through.
Only in Florida. Those Gators are going to be like the Jacksonville Jaguars beating the Patriots on Sunday. Duval!
You can only hope. You can only hope.
That's our show, The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Murchard, our producers.
Jason Zabka, our technical director. Our theme music by Miami musician Aaron Libos.
I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening.